Welcome to the Battleground Wisconsin. My name is Matt Brusky, and I'm the Deputy Director here at Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Welcome to another spring here in Wisconsin. Beautiful week. We're joined by our Executive Director, Robert Craig. Robert, good to have you.
Good to be here, Matt.
Oh, we got a good show for you. I can just tell you in the pre-show talk, Robert and I were tussling back and forth. So good topics, super important discussions today that get to some very broad, fundamental questions and issues that we as a movement need to be thinking about. We will be joined later in the show by Peter Rickman and Laura Dresser. Peter Rickman is with MASH, which is the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Union. And Laura Dresser is with COWS, the center. Let me get this right, because it's under a new name, the High Road Strategy Center at the UW in Madison. And we're thrilled to have them on later to talk about some studying and a report around the deal that was cut around Fiserv and the public money around Fiserv, and how it has led to really, you know, first of all, union rights and some broader community benefits that make it worth studying. And we're going to have those folks on to talk more about that, because we think it has very important policy implications. But Robert, we got a bunch of other things to talk about, including some local stuff around referendums, school referendums. We talked a little bit about that last week. Robert wants to talk a bit about what's been going on with the Voss recall effort. We are going to dive into the implications of the Arizona Supreme Court abortion decision, because it's pretty profound. And we are also, if we get time, we're going to touch upon, you may have seen the new numbers came out for where we're at with inflation. And it is a bit back on the rise, mostly because of gas and rent and housing, which I don't think will surprise folks. But we're going to talk about that and what that implication might be for the election. Robert, I want to start. With this articles that you're seeing around a study. Robert, who was it? Was it Wisconsin Policy Forum? Who did the study again? I don't have the... Wisconsin Policy Forum, right?
Yes.
Wisconsin Policy Forum did a study looking at the performance of the referendums that were on for school districts, both this year, but then looking back using every even year. So they're looking to try to see if there's any kind of trend happening with school referendums. And they found that 60% of the referendums this year passed, which is a less of a percentage than we've been seeing over the last couple decades. Robert, we spent a lot of time debriefing the implications of the referendums on last week's show, but your thoughts on this research and just the broader questions around the funding of public education in Wisconsin?
I think the research can be misinterpreted and misleading. So let me tell you what it does say and what it doesn't say. And what it says specifically is that the passage rate of 60% in this spring election was the lowest since 2010. It was an upward trend from 2012 through before, though the highest, the peak was 2018, where 90% passed. And as you know, you have to take into account that each and every budget cycle, this gerrymandered legislature, and with the cooperation of this governor last time and the deal he cut, vastly underfunded education, and it is supposed to be, remember the original compact was two-thirds would come from the state, i.e. from the most progressive form of taxation, the state, the income tax, though Republicans would like to make that less progressive and had a lot of bad plans that were mostly shot down by Governor Evers. And so year after year, right, this is put on property taxes, which are more regressive, right, and people really feel very directly. And when we in Milwaukee, where it was a very close vote, it was after a forced sales tax increase by this legislature, by the same shared revenue deal I referenced before. So I do think that it's right to suggest that there is a some logical stopping point where this cannot be the permanent funding mechanism for public schools to catch up because they're still behind inflation, dramatically behind. And the state must do its job. And it starts with having fair maps, but then it has to do with winning elections. And it has to do with actually having, if the Democrats can get control, the fortitude to fight that out. Let's say we have closer margins and still a Democratic governor. I think you, as you said in our pre-discussion, which you can get into now, this doesn't look at how many were on the ballot and a whole lot, and that would affect these numbers. In other words, a lot more people who were probably more desperate school districts and threw them on ballots without the political support they needed, and they went down. They're difficult unless you're, but you know you have the politics for it and the organizing campaign to get it done.
Yeah, Robert, thank you for, first of all, going over those numbers very clearly. Let me just start by saying 60% as a low end is still a pretty impressive number. And what is, I think, what we're seeing and why the percentage is lower is, well, first of all, the number of districts that have had to go to referendum the last two cycles is astounding, right? And it's unconscionable. It obviously screams that you have a funding problem from the state where your primary resources come from. So you're kind of really screwed if they don't properly fund you, which for many districts has been going on a long time. But for a number of other districts, particularly districts that are in, even more affluent areas, suburban areas, and very Republican areas, they're feeling just the year after year and the particular pernicious impacts of COVID, its costs on the district, the inflation that we're all experiencing, hitting them too, right? So you're now having referendums the last two cycles in a lot of very conservative, very Republican areas, right? Which makes these referendums challenging. And the dollar amounts this cycle are significant, right? Like MPS's was like four times what the one a few years ago. The ones that passed out in New Richmond, those are huge dollar amounts for districts that size. It's stunning, right? But it gets to the lack of funding. And this is what I want to hammer home. Folks, Robert mentioned the maps. Yes, absolutely existentially critical opportunity to change what's going on. But here's the reality. These new maps are going to make the assembly and the Senate closer and tighter, which means Republicans and others are back in play for like a hardcore funding discussion about what the hell's going on. In fact, there's been a lot of Republican leaders who have gone around and said, the truth of the matter is, many people in their caucus have no clue how the funding of public schools goes, and they haven't really had to think about it much. And they have to now because it's come home to roost in so many districts. Like, and so you, it's hard to have an assembly or a Senate district where you don't have, significant amounts of pressure and they're being forced to figure this out. So there is a new opportunity, but here's the deal. This gets back to the conversations we've been having. What kind of Democrats end up in the legislature? Who is choosing to run for office right now? Who are we getting in our networks who are progressive, who will not abandon public education and fight for it? And that includes putting pressure on the governor to have a different strategy this time around. I want to shout out to, I don't say this for, shout out to Greta Neubauer, Representative, Senate Minority Leader Neubauer.
Assembly. Assembly.
Assembly, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not. It's morning. I haven't had enough coffee. Thank you, Robert. Look, her comments last week about public education were some of the strongest comments I've heard in a while about being committed to absolutely make public education the dominant issue in this election. And that's what I want to say, folks. We have got to be talking to everybody who runs for office. Will you properly fund public education? And that means more than what the hell we've been doing, that our district should not have to go to referendum. They should fund the two-thirds commitment that they promised, or they should get rid of these ridiculous caps. I think they should actually, they need to fund public education properly. And that is a defining issue in addition to healthcare, right? What the hell's going on with our health systems? What's happening in Eau Claire? The lack of accepting Badger Care, expanding access to Badger Care public option, right? And then additional things we need to do to rein in this insane healthcare system. Folks, add childcare and you have a damn platform that I think most people want. And so, Robert, any further thoughts on both the report or just, you know, this just dying situation? I mean, public education is the thing that a democracy has to get right. Robert?
So one of our challenges is problem blindness. This is a lot of problems. There's not enough deeper understanding of how bad the climate crisis is and what is actually we're called upon to do, right? And in public education, it's very dangerous to try to go for political purposes and say things are great, this much more money was appropriated, because you're confusing people in a democracy. You need to be really clear how terribly underfunded it is. That's been underfunded just based on the rate of inflation by hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, probably into the billions over the last decade and a half. And that needs to be serious. And the governor needs to stop talking about the aggregate number of the increase as if that means anything, given the cost of things in our society. And I know why he's doing it. His political advisors who want to keep him popular think that it's good for a governor to say, see, I got this, I got that. I think there's a moral responsibility to say, this is a crisis and it needs to be addressed, because you need to frame it up as an issue people will vote on in order to make Gretchen Neubauer the assembly speaker, not only the assembly majority leader.
And look, the reality is the governor is going to have a new dynamic. He's been able to be, let's say it, he's been a fairly successful goaltender, but there's been absolutely no effort to have a counterattack or think strategically that way. But there is now, with these new maps, there will be a legislature that will allow us to have a completely different strategy. So again, shout out Minority Leader Neubauer for being very clear that we can't keep funding the voucher program this way. And they were very explicit that there needs to be efforts to claw back and to take back some of the voucher money, because we just can't fund two school districts. Folks, you're listening to The Battleground Wisconsin. When we come back, Robert is going to tell us the latest on the Voss recall effort and why it matters. You're listening to The Battleground Wisconsin, where Citizen Action. You can find us at citizenactionwi.org. We're also very active on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media. We'll see you right after this break. Welcome back. Robert, Voss recall effort. One of the most incompetent efforts from the outside that I can tell, other than they certainly are the Energizer Bunny and refuse to quit. Robert, please. Why should I even care about this effort? Please let me know. Let our listeners know.
Well, it does indicate a fissure, at least within the Wisconsin Republican Party, between the traditional right-wing conservatives, that would be the Scott Walker kind of crew, right, which Voss is out of, and Trump and MAGA. But it sort of maybe what happens when the MAGA activists try to do something without the institutional power and know-how of the Republican Party. And so in a way, what does that tell you? I mean, it tells you about this fissure, right, that is a Cold War, because it's kept underneath Voss will do nothing to prevent Trump from winning Wisconsin, quite the contrary. But it tells you how much of the competence of this fascist movement is actually brought by Republicans, right? Their party, and the fact that they support this for power purposes all over the country, and what the Trump campaign would look like if the institutions behind the party, which is also all of the corporations and billionaires that fund them, corporations are back to funding all of the insurrectionists, okay? All that brief time when they were going to not do it, that long past, because they have no commitment to democracy and don't seem to understand how bad a move towards authoritarianism would be for them and their businesses and their profits.
Well, that is clearly an excellent point about not only the fissure, but just look, the dysfunction of those folks without clearly these institutions and not just, you mentioned the corporate institutions, but all the others that help prop up, you know, the Republican Party in this movement. Thank you for raising that. Robert, want to get your comments, and I want to just have a brief conversation about the Arizona Supreme Court's abortion decision and the implications immediately, first just for policy, right? But then, right, this is the defining issue right now in the presidential election, right, along with immigration, right? And Trump this week, I believe it was this week, I get confused. He made a very public comment to after much sort of dodging that he wasn't going to sign a national abortion ban, if you believe that. But interestingly enough, this dodge, which shows he knows this issue is just killing him, that he somehow believes this is done, it's a state's issue, nothing to worry about here, everything's going to be good. And then Robert, 2 days later, the Arizona Supreme Court drops a bomb, basically, that like blows up any sort of pretext that Trump, what he was saying is correct. Robert, tell our listeners more and your thoughts.
Well, Donald Trump and Carrie Lake, the Senate candidate in the critical Arizona Senate race, are bulls in china shops, but they're not very good dancers. And so this kind of two-step, you know, do-si-do on abortion isn't going to do anything. All you have to know is that Trump is only president the first time because of the evangelical Christian movement, which is a purely political authoritarian movement these days. And he needs them, but he also wants to win the election. So he's trying to what Bill Clinton used to call with Dick Morris when he had Dick Morris as advisor, triangulation. He's going to seem like he wouldn't do the dirty, but then wink, wink, nod, nod to the other side, I'm with you. I mean, this is the implication of appointing the judges overturned Roe versus Wade and said to the states. And anyone who believes that he will safely veto any national abortion ban is a sucker. Let's face it, and Americans don't like to be suckers. But the Arizona decision, you know, in Wisconsin, we had our 1848 law. They've gone back to territorial laws that are 70 years older than the state is. And it was determined by judges originally that were appointed by Abraham Lincoln. Okay, so it's a zombie law that was rehabilitated. And it just shows you what right-wing judges will do. They will do anything to achieve a right-wing outcome, and including, you know, look at it. The U.S. Supreme Court said, well, you know, that provision of the 40th Amendment about insurrectionists running for office, it's not realistic, right? We don't see how it could actually work with every state and making the decision. And so we're going to just ignore the clear statutory wording and the intent of the framers of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War. But now in this case, no realism. We're going to decide this is the original law of Arizona and it's now operative. I mean, it just, there's no consistency at all because they're politicians in robes.
Well, look, I mean, I think Trump thought he was really brilliant this week. And it just reveals again, this issue ain't going away. It's going to continue to be a defining issue. And folks, just the surreality of how surreal all this is. You got Trump suggesting that everything's okay because the Democrats in Arizona will make it okay. It's like, what? Like, it's just too much, especially given this guy would love to, if he could just wipe out the Democratic Party, would. So the notion it's too much. It's too much. But it was, again, another stunning week that sort of reveals just this historic and epically strange election time we find ourselves in. But yet, let's just be clear, like, we're not talking about nothing. This is absolutely critical issues of major substance. So, Robert, before we take a break and we're joined by some amazing guests, I did want to get your thoughts on the news. I think it just broke in the last 24 hours that inflation is on the rise again. It's not like it's runaway. It's ticking up. And it's being largely attributed to gas prices, which do start to go up this time of year, but also housing, right? And particularly rental housing, which we know is a legit issue and has the inflation's been, you know, outrageous for a number of years now. But Robert, your thoughts on particular, you know, any thoughts? This is clearly the issue that seems to be one of the number one things Biden is trying to contend with in terms of an assessment of his job as president. Robert, your thoughts?
Yeah, voters absolutely vote in presidential elections on their perception of economic performance for that, not big numbers like GDP, which doesn't necessarily affect an individual voter, things like their relative income increase or decrease. And that's that is a perception thing, because people may not realize that they got raises in excess of inflation. They could just focus on inflation, and that's what Republicans are trying to do. What's important is this is like 80 years of political science, also shows that voters don't really pay attention to performance, except for maybe starting around the May or June of the election year. So any past performance is discounted. So if you were to have a president, a very bad economic performance just over those 4 or 5 months, you would be punished for it, even if you had tremendous, you know, performance before. One of the things Franklin Delano Roosevelt got right was he had upticks at the right time for his reelections. He could have been punished if there had been a downtick, even if he had made a lot more ground up in digging out of the Great Depression. So we're at the point of consequences, and there's a debate about, you know, are you better off? Which is bizarre, because 4 years ago, the country was in free fall. So the Republican narrative is a big lie. Inflation ticked up, Matt, from 3.2% to 3.5%. So it's not a disaster, but it means the Fed probably won't lower interest rates right away, which will prime the pump less and therefore create less good economic circumstances. So that is not good for President Biden's reelection. And as you pointed out, there are underlying factors that we, as the broader Democratic coalition, progressives and the far left and centrists, need to get our hands around. We're going to have a discussion later, Matt, about stadium deals, the huge difference between the Deer District and the Bucks, and what happened with the Brewers. In other words, things that actually benefit the workers and not just the billionaire owners. And with housing, we've got a commodified housing market that's in the interest of real estate and development. And until we actually intervene as a public through government, through our democracy in the system to guarantee affordable housing to everyone, this will continue. So the Republicans will blame Biden for this. The blame is in that they've made democracy unworkable. You can't pass anything because of the MAGA House of Representatives, and the Democrats were not unified enough to have that vision. Some of us do. Some of us think we don't need to do that. We don't certainly don't hear it from a lot of mainline Democrats, but like Governor Evers. So I think that we're in a situation where Biden could lose this election. The economics are not in a free fall. They should hopefully that does not happen. But they're not improving enough in perception that there's going to be a clear win where they feel like most voters and swing voters think they're definitely better off because of the president, especially with the disinformation coming from the right-wing noise machine and the Republican Party.
Well, look, we're going to continue to track this. Again, look, it gets to this point. There needs to be a forward-looking message. There needs to be a continued clear message about what's going to happen in the next term. It can't just be, look, here's what I did for you, as if it's somehow alone going to carry the day. Thank you, Robert. With that, though, we're going to take a break. We'll be joined right after this break by our special guest. You're listening to the Battleground Wisconsin. All right, welcome back to the Battleground Wisconsin. Again, folks, we are really fortunate to be joined by two guests. We've had them here before, and we're thrilled to have them back. First, I want to introduce Laura Dresser. Laura is the Associate Director of the High Road Strategy Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. For you old progressives, you may remember it as COWS. It's an amazing research center. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Peter Rickman, the president of MASH, which is the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Union. Peter, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you here because you're here with a couple of things that we like on the show. Information, facts, data, and that has actual real policy implications that we all need to, as progressives, understand and start acting on. So, Laura, I'm going to go to you first. Y'all released this amazing report. It's called From Community Benefits to Collective Bargaining and Back. And it has some really important findings for what happened around the development of the FISERV, the creation of it, and its implication for workers. So, Laura, give our listeners the top lines. What are the most important things that y'all found?
I think what we see in this story, I think in the background, in a way, there is the question of economic development, what we're doing, what public policy is trying to do with economic development dollars that it throws around. This is a kind of fundamental conundrum that sort of sits behind every economic development deal. And the other thing is, like, what are the true economic problems in Milwaukee? And that's the lack of decent jobs and the deep racial disparities. And what this story really is about the community organizing that made a different kind of community benefits agreement possible for people in Milwaukee. And that community benefits agreement has some specific aspects around the service workers that will hold the jobs in the long term that set the groundwork for there to be a union that represents those workers. Community benefits agreement sets the groundwork for the collective bargaining agreement. And that is what is an attempt to change or beginning to lift the floor under service work in Milwaukee, because now you have a union that represents service workers that can pay attention to new economic development deals, that can raise the floor and demonstrate a new model inside that workplace. And so you can see in what's going on in MASH, this second contract, you can see really strong wage gains, well above what the external kind of outside that shop marketplace for workers is, but also real evidence of the kind of priorities that workers bring to that contract negotiation around schedules and around their own lives. And this, again, like, just service sector work doesn't have these things. So I know I'm talking, like, this is a lot to take from a report, but I really feel like this is the sort of breadth of what's going on in this story.
Robert.
So you touched on something very important, Laura, that is the purpose of economic development. I did a lot of research into economic development, its history, the research on it during the Foxconn boondoggle, where, like with the Brewers stadium deal, we were one of the lone voices willing to call it out. And, it was always sold originally when economic development occurred as something that was for everyone's benefit, for the community, to help get jobs, to help people get up the ladder and have access to the American dream. But in practice, it's really been very unaccountable and has been a business subsidy. It's just been a stealth way for the public to subsidize for-profit businesses who are promising to provide benefits that they're not. One example in Milwaukee was the whole water hub thing, where we were going to get all sorts of water jobs. And Mark Levine from UWM really blew the lid off of that one. But we have all these developments in Walker's Point related to water, which are not producing any jobs that people need the most. You can just see the workforce, the small technical workforce that walks in every morning. Our office used to be right over in front of that complex. And part of what this is about, Laura, it seems like, is recentering what the purpose is, because the people who want the subsidies, the businesses, will claim benefits. And we got that for the Brewers debate, right? About look at all the jobs. How could this not create jobs? Contrary to a consensus of 300 studies showing it has virtually no benefit overall, right? These huge multi-million, multi-billion dollar subsidies. And so it seems like part of this is having actual standards, that if we're going to use public money, it has to have actual concrete results for average people, not just be something that helps a for-profit business or an individual billionaire.
Absolutely. I think that question of transparency and standards and who you're accountable to, I mean, this gets to the question of where power is in this and whether the community is mobilized. And this is why unions matter so much to the ability to maintain the standards, right? Like, you can write in a standard, but if you don't have a union to represent the workers and negotiate new wages in times of high inflation, that standard becomes irrelevant. And, you know, the contract just makes that clear.
So this gets to you, Peter Rickman. You obviously represent as the president of MASH, that aspect, the workers. I'd like you to talk about that part, because that's critical. And it was also critical in what Laura talked about, the idea that there be, you know, that there is a campaign and a whole group of folks who work on making this happen. The Bucks just don't agree to these things without a campaign and organization. Could you talk more about that and the critical role that MASH and other allied forces have played in this kind of success?
Absolutely. And I'm obviously sitting here talking to two of the people who signed on to our original declaration of demands for living wages and union rights and access to jobs for folks who need them the most, with this, what is now known as the Deer District. Matt and Robert, again, thank you for that. I mean, we're 8 years past that point, and here we are in a new day for service and hospitality workers, because popular forces, community organizations, unions stood up and said, hey, wait a minute. For every time that we're told by the billionaires and the boss class, just give us more public money and sunshine, puppies and rainbows and good jobs will follow. You know, maybe this time we should actually have something binding and accountable. And that moment, I think, here in Milwaukee, where so many policymakers have just continued previously to shovel money at corporations and developers and the rich and cross their fingers and their hands and prayed and hoped something good would come for the city racked by a crisis of racial and economic inequality, that was the first moment that policymakers at the state and local level said, hey, you know what? Let's actually get it in writing. If you're going to tell us all these great things will happen, just like they did with the Grand Avenue Mall, or just like they told us with the first round of what became Miller Park or every other subsidy project that's ever happened, let's get it in writing this time that we're going to have good jobs for folks who need them the most. And so getting an accountable, legally binding community benefits agreement means that we can see real things happening for working class people in this town. It wouldn't be an appearance on this podcast for me if I didn't say Milwaukee is defined by a crisis of racial and economic inequality and injustice rooted in labor market outcomes shifting for the tens of thousands of working class people up and down the north side and the near south side who used to find employment and good union jobs and factories and foundries that are gone. And they're not coming back. And they've been replaced by an explosion of low-wage service sector jobs at the heart of the racialized income inequality economy. And this was the opportunity to start to change the direction. And so what's come from this community benefits agreement is, as Laura and colleagues have noted in this report, not just a charter for how this development would proceed and some standards to which it would be accountable, but a charter for service and hospitality work in the future, driven by, led by the workers who are employed here. And so we built an organization to monitor and enforce and implement the community benefits agreement, to win a collective bargaining agreement that blew the original wage standards out of the water here. And in some cases have, from the old Bradley Center wages, more than doubled and grown the wage levels 150% and provided just cause and progressive discipline in the grievance procedure.
Peter, to that point, can I ask you to elaborate on one thing? Because I think it'll help some of our union folks who better understand conceptually how this operates. You have described it like a hiring hall. Comparisons, I think that's really helpful for our listeners to understand how your operating and intervening, at least in one way that like some other labor folks might better understand, and how that can be super beneficial to changing a market. Talk more about that. I think you're already brushing upon it, but so some of our other folks might understand the role and how this is working.
Yeah, I think it's a really important thing here to recognize that labor markets in the service and hospitality industry don't function like those in industrial employment, or, you know, even things like hospitals. When you look at what happens in food and beverage service or hospitality, there's not one job that someone has that they're working at 40 hours a week for some period of time. Workers piece together multiple casual, contingent, part-time jobs. They typically, you know, don't provide benefits. They're, of course, low wages. And workers are the ones that bear the burden of coordinating this friction-filled labor market. They got to piece it together across their part-time jobs and figure out how to make those schedules work. And more often than not, they can't. So what we're building here at the center of the labor market, starting with Fiserv Forum and expanding beyond that, is something that smooths that labor market friction, that coordinates, that helps provide access for workers to jobs, now good jobs, and deals with what employers need and figures out how to match the needs of workers and the needs of employers up. It's kind of like what people, you know, recognize in the building trades or longshoring, or of course we all know about the needle trades in the 19-teens. It's of course something that's just in our DNA here. It's a joke, guys. Nobody knows what that is, but these are models that have existed in the labor movement, and we're applying them to the hospitality industry labor market that we have here today. And so what that's meant is that with an organization of, by, and for service and hospitality workers, and this approach on both the demand side of winning standards and best in industry union contracts, and on the supply side in trying to get a handle on workforce pipelines and pools, we can start to change the way that the hospitality industry labor market works for workers and employers alike. That's what's been birthed by this project here.
And with that, thank you, Peter. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Laura about some very important, what are some of the key policy implications and things from the report. You're listening to the Battleground Wisconsin. Welcome back to the Battleground Wisconsin. We're talking with Laura Dresser and Peter Rickman. Laura, Peter was talking a lot about how this actually works out in practical terms that a lot of our folks might be able to relate to. I'd like you to, you know, as the author of the report, could you, you've touched upon this a bit, but what do you see as the most important findings? Because, you know, this has critical public policy implications. If I was in a alder, a mayor, you know, or other elected official, state reps in the case of, say, the Brewers when they were dealing with it, what's your number one takeaway that you would tell those folks?
You know, I would say, what do you think you're going to get from this, and how are you going to hold people accountable to that? I think it's important to see in the Milwaukee context, right? This is a state that has sort of preempted the ability of a city to put a lot of standards on economic development. And even in that context, having a mobilized community make a transparent and accountable deal with the developer, right? So that's, you know, and having the public policymakers saying, go make a deal. We're not going to give you the permits you need until you work this out, right? And so it's that leadership at the public policy level to say, I want real answers from my community before I'm going to invest in you. And I need to see accountability to the community in that. Can I just add one more thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Go.
And then the second thing is a lot of things get called community benefits agreements. And a lot of it I think of as sort of businesses doing nice thing. We'll do a park. We'll fund a kids center, whatever. And this is like, what are the jobs that we are making? And how do we make sure that the workers there get a union if they want? And so it's labor peace, standards on the jobs, labor peace, agreement, you know, and an agreement to move quickly to the first contract, that you are not going to resist unionization. That also is an essential element, not just like good things and not just like, yeah, we promise to have good jobs, but like, here's how we're going to let our workers have a union if they want one.
Peter, from your perspective as a labor leader, same question. What's your advice to local electeds as when they are faced with these kinds of major public investments, and also how they should be thinking about their service markets?
Building a Milwaukee for all of us requires transforming the jobs that cooks and cleaners and bartenders and baristas and servers and security guards have, something that the High Road Strategy Center is estimated to be. I think, Laura, the number's around 55,000-ish people in Milwaukee. If we can transform those jobs into good union jobs with living wages and benefits and dignity, rights, and respect that comes only with a union contract, we can build a Milwaukee for all of us, for folks on the north side, the near south side, every part of our city, for every working person. That's the vision that we have. And in this report, we see that there is a model. This isn't something where we just shrug our shoulders and say, oh, guess it sucks that we've got crappy jobs for folks who are disproportionately Black and brown folks and women. You know what? I guess we're just going to have to hope that more corporate headquarters locate downtown in these bright, shiny buildings. No, we have a model here so that we can say, it's not going to be built, you know, it's not going to be told to folks from above. It's not going to be imposed from above. We have to build it from below. And we can say that every development that comes forward, if it's going to include janitors and housekeepers and cleaners, it's going to employ cooks and cashiers, or, you know, bartenders and baristas, we are going to ensure that these are good union jobs. And we can build something that crosses the labor market here for folks who are employed in those jobs, and over time transform them. And I think at this moment in time, it's incredibly important that Milwaukee policymakers say, this is our model. It's our standard and expectation. You all may remember that in July of 2019, the council, the Common Council, adopted something called the Core Development Zone Resolution, the Community-Oriented, Responsible, and Equitable Development Zone Resolution, that says that when downtown development comes forward, if it's going to include these kinds of post-construction service and hospitality jobs, the expectation of the city of Milwaukee is that they will have a community benefits agreement substantially similar to that of the Deer District. And that's kind of pointing the way forward. And let me just paint a picture for you guys, because right now, policymakers at the city level, the local level here, and to some extent the state level, have an opportunity to shift the labor market expectations with new developments coming forward that will have a knock-on effect in the rest of the hospitality industry labor market. What's good for the Deer District ought to be good for the Iron District. This so-called proposed Iron District with a soccer stadium and mixed-use project attached to it, something that the High Road Strategy Center has studied and written additional reports on, and folks should check those out at their website. That is something that could complement the work at Fiserv Forum. You know, if you work in an arena in fall, winter, and spring, you could work in a soccer stadium in spring and summer. Right now, we've got talk about potentially a new hotel being developed near Fiserv Forum. That should be covered by this. Go ahead.
No, look, and I know you're focusing on Milwaukee. I want to call a quick audible, because we have a little bit left. And I mean that literally. The good folks in Green Bay are currently being pressured by the Packers to renegotiate their contract and asking for, I believe it's like $40 million in previous revenue. Advice for the good folks. I believe there's a good chance Mayor Genrich or his chief of staff or some of the newly elected alders are listening to this podcast. What's your advice for them? Because to me, that's a bunch of crap, and we need a strategy to push back against what the Packers are trying to do to bully the city of Green Bay. Your thoughts?
Yeah, the good news is there's already a beachhead there. The roughly 70, 75 vendors who sell beer and other beverages at Lambeau Field, employed by a company called Delaware North, organized with MASH. We ran an NLRB election in the fall. 87% of the folks voted yes. Union yes, and are negotiating a contract right now. And actually, just yesterday, we were making progress in bargaining. And I said to the chief negotiator for Delaware North, you know, hey, why don't you guys go to the Packers and commit to doing labor peace here? The negotiations in the city stadium district and Packers realm for a new lease have kind of gotten a little funky. And, you know, I got to imagine that if the city of Green Bay policymakers saw that Lambeau Field had pledged to go wall to wall union with guaranteed union rights for workers to, as Laura said, exercise that if they want to form a union. And by the way, when workers have the right to form a union, they absolutely do it every time. You know, that would really change the way folks are looking at $40 million for a profitable operation there. So, you know, policymakers in Green Bay, policymakers in Madison, policymakers in Racine, Kenosha, wherever, should say at the bare minimum, you know, if there's going to be public money involved, and Lambo is the best example we have right now because it looks just like Fiserv Forum in many ways, just guarantee that folks have the right to form a union and build an economic future rooted in a balancing of power between the bosses, the employers, and workers. And that's how we're going to transform service and hospitality employment across this state.
Thank you, Peter. Laura, any thoughts you have?
Yeah, I agree with... Yeah. I agree. I really do think we've gotten so used to this hat in hand of, like, give me money for the people who have the money. We resist, you know, redistribution in every way except up. And I think, you know, policymakers just have to get clear about when giant corporations, profitable corporations that are paying lots of people lots of money, are coming to you and asking to, you know, be paid to stay. What are you getting for people who don't earn a lot of money? You know, what are you getting? You know, and why do we keep doing this? You know, so I think Peter's answer is right. And then I think the other thing to see is that it really matters to have community and labor mobilization around this. It isn't, you know, it can't be driven just as a policy deal with the businesses, because the accountability and the mobilization, the responsiveness.
Thank you for saying that, because that would be my strongest advice to policymakers is slow the hell down. They often feel like they're in a rush and they just bend to the demands. And by the way, it is a strategy of MLB and others now to jam these through and to make them seem like an emergency, right? The Brewers thing, they did their best to make it seem like an emergency. And the frustration is when you don't have politicians, or at least a majority, willing to like just be like, okay, we get why you want this, but can we slow this down and have a public discussion of what's best? I felt like the whole Brewer thing was ramrodded through the hearings. That was not set up to actually really hear. How many state legislators around the state even held public hearings on their own where they went and got or did things? I know a handful of folks did, but most didn't, right? And so that to me is the biggest thing. I saw Eric Genrich broke off talks with the Packers. Bravo. Let's create time to build public pressure and real consensus about what the public interest is. We get what their interest is. Like, nobody begrudges them for wanting more, but that's not our interest. That should not be the public interest. Peter, Laura, final thoughts before we go, other than to say thank you for this report and thank you for joining us.
I just want to say, you know, this is continuing a line of work that folks in Good Jobs, Livable Neighborhoods and now Citizen Action have been up to for a while. And it takes that long view of transforming economic development from the way we've described it, just upward wealth redistribution, into being a tool that actually delivers for working class people. So I just want to thank you all for being at the forefront of this for so long. And thank you for having us on to continue the conversation and the struggle to build a Milwaukee for all of us and economic justice for every single working person in Wisconsin.
And thank you, Laura.
Good bottom line. Thanks for having me.
Well, look, coming back at you, you both have been around here a long time doing this work, and we appreciate you. We appreciate the work you do and that you took the time to join us today. And I'll just say, like, I deliberately added Green Bay, and I'm looking at all you other cities across the state. We need to have more accountability. This isn't just a Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay. Like, all of our cities should be asking more, because you're constantly asked for TIFs. Come talk to us. We need to build a better Wisconsin. Thank you all. Appreciate it. That, folks, we got to wrap up this Battleground Wisconsin. We want to thank our producer, Brian Wildridge, who makes this show happen every week. Can't do it without him. Folks, please join Citizen Action. Sign the link. We can't do this without you, right? Like, there is no democracy without us in it, moving it. So please join Citizen Action. And, folks, we'll see you next week here at the Battleground Wisconsin.